Support for this episode of the podcast comes from our patrons at Patreon. Go to patreon.com/chasingearhart to join the chase and become a patron today. On the morning of July 2nd, 1937, Amelia Earhart and her navigator Fred Noonan disappeared over the Pacific Ocean without a trace. 81 years later, all over the world lie scattered pieces of their puzzle, waiting to be put together. Welcome to Season 2 of the Chasing Earhart Podcast.
Only a short time ago, Amelia Earhart checked over every detail of her $80,000 flying laboratory in preparation for her round-the-world flight. This was to have been her greatest achievement, a sky dash of 28,000 miles. With her husband, George Palmer Putnam on right, she discussed the hazardous course which had been plotted for her by Fred Noonan, the navigator who embarked with Miss Earhart upon this great flight, a flight which was to have marked her retirement to aeronautical research. Then to a waiting world came news of disaster as the plane failed to reach tiny Howland Island in mid-Pacific. A British freighter, the Coast Guard, and the Navy sped to the search. The battleship Colorado steaming out from Honolulu under forced draft. From California, the aircraft carrier Lexington, with 3,000 men and 72 planes aboard, races into the distant Pacific to join the greatest searching party in the history of aviation.
David Avalone is never shy about expressing his feelings. Considered by all that know him as a passionate thinker, David has a unique way of expression that causes readers to think about their own feelings in a brand new way. Tonight, on the 58th episode of the Chasing Earhart podcast, David joins us via Zoom to break down and discuss his story, Doc Savage, Ring of Fire, why he chose Amelia Earhart to star opposite Doc in that adventure, and why Amelia's actions in the 1930s continue to make a stand for women in the 21st century. Our guest today on the Chasing Earhart podcast is a friend of the project. We've actually already shot with him for the documentary Golden Apple not too long ago. His name is David Avalone. It's absolutely a pleasure for me. David, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
So let's do this. Let's start out with the same question I ask every guest that we ever do podcasts with. Can you give us a little bit about your education, your professional background, please?
My education and professional background. I graduated from Bard College with a film degree. Bard doesn't really do minors, but I spent an inordinate amount of time at Bard with history and science history, particularly. So that has some bearing on what we're talking about today, I think. And I've always been a history obsessive. I think if I wasn't doing what I'm doing, I would be a history teacher. You look over the stuff I've written, there's a lot of closet history teacher going on in my comic books. Been in the film industry since I got out of college, 31 years ago now. Knocked around film doing all sorts of things, produced movies, directed a couple of movies, but the last 5 years I've been about 50% of the time a professional comic book writer. And though I will say the last film I worked on, I was the editor and sort of second unit director of a documentary about General Pershing, the general who won the First World War on the American side. Which was a fascinating thing and played into all of my interests. So yeah, that's what I do now. It's about 60-70% comic book writing now.
And that brings us, it's a good segue, brings us to what we're going to get into in just a little bit with you, with Doc Savage, Ring of Fire, and Amelia Earhart. But before we get to that, the second question I always ask everybody, and I think for you it's particularly going to be interesting, it's really kind of a two-part question. The first part of it is, do you have any early recollections of Amelia Earhart? Like, if you think back, what are your earliest recollections? And secondly, and this will be a segue into Doc Savage, but what brought her into your life professionally?
That's a really good question, and I must have learned about her studying history when I was a kid. Like, I can't remember the first book, the first movie, the first anything that introduced me to her, so it must have been all the way back. But I've always particularly been interested in the 30s and 40s, so I'm sure that came along with that, and aviation and all of that, and the, particularly the build-up to the Second World War. So I'm sure she appeared in my life pretty early as I studied that stuff. She actually entered my life professionally for the first time. I don't know if I even brought this up in the documentary. In 1989, I was writing a book about time travel for a game company called West End Games called Vulture Warriors of Dimension X. Part of it was, since it was for a role-playing game, it was like basically a how to tell a fun adventure with time travel in your game. And one of the stories I worked on had Amelia Earhart in it. And sort of in the same way as I did later in Ring of Fire last year, I attempted to write a different ending to her story than history does, which I think is what every single person who does an Amelia Earhart fictional project tries to write a satisfying ending to her story, because it is ultimately an unsatisfying conclusion. And then 2 years ago, a year and a half ago, I was offered the chance to write Doc Savage. And I thumbed through this great history book called The Timetables of History, looking for what in the 1930s would have attracted Doc Savage's attention. Again, because of the history thing, I like using real events and real people. I came across the disappearance of Amelia again, and I went, you know, that's a, sure. Amelia is a prominent American scientist and explorer, and she would have known Doc Savage, and Doc's cousin is a female aviator, and she, obviously Amelia had a particular interest in female aviators. There were so few of them that, as you know, the first organization she started was called 99, because there were 99 female pilots she could, you know, identify and locate in whatever it was, 35, 36, something like that. So I thought, well, Pat Savage would have been a member of the 99s, would have met her, and the whole story sort of grew out of there. So it's a 4-issue miniseries in which, among other things, Doc Savage and his cousin find the fate of Amelia Earhart. She saves San Francisco.
That's the comic book part of it right there.
That's the comic book part of it.
Let me ask you this, because, and this is something I think while we're talking about stuff we really didn't shoot in the documentary, I want to ask you from a research standpoint, because, you know, you've told me that you're obviously you're really big into history, as am I. And I think it's interesting to sort of kind of marry the concepts that you married, really, because you have this fictional character in Doc Savage who fits into historical stuff. You have Amelia Earhart, who is this, you know, iconic American, you know, citizen, and this is history is one of history's biggest people. And then you have just the historical aspect of it. And I've obviously read through all 4 issues, and they're just really beautifully written, and it's a lot of detail, a lot of like little nuances and things that you like, if you look it up, you'll find that it's true, which is really cool. Like,
I always try to do that.
Yeah. So I guess my question to you is, what was that process? Because we have a lot of young folks who follow the project that want to do kind of what you're doing. And I'm just wondering if you can kind of talk a little bit about that process for you from a historical standpoint and a writer standpoint.
The tricky thing about comic books is the schedules are fast and brutal, and I have to jump off pretty quickly. So I was unable, like I had bought years ago the great biography, the recent biography, East to the Dawn. Is that the right title?
Yes, Susan Butler.
I hate to mangle the author's title. And really loved it, really read it, got a lot out of it. Got the key thing that makes the climax of the comic beautiful. I use a poem that Amelia really wrote about courage as she's sacrificing herself. And I love that that I end the comic with Amelia's actual words on courage and sacrifice and all of that. So the process is I gather as many materials as I can. I try to start with a subject I at least know something about, so I'm not completely floundering. And then there's a domino effect of how research informs story. And as an example, the best example I can think of is, okay, well, I wanted the bad guy to create, he has a machine, it's science fiction, he has a machine that touches off volcanoes. I wanted him to touch off a volcano in the South Pacific under a U.S. Navy base. So I go to Wikipedia, U.S. Navy bases in the South Pacific. I find out that there was a half-constructed one on the Palmyra Atoll that they never quite got around to finishing during World War II. I was like, okay, well, that's a weird little mystery that they never finished this island. In the first draft, I mistakenly referred to it as an island instead of an atoll. And when it came back for lettering, I went, Well, that's actually a sort of cheap geology joke, if I keep it that way, because it's an island until a volcano blows it in half, because an atoll is sort of a crescent-shaped coral reef.
Right.
Like, so it was an island once, and now we call it an atoll because John Sunlight's disaster machine blew it in half. So that's the kind of joke that no one will laugh at, but it's buried there if you want to care about it. And I went, okay, so it's a U.S. Navy base. It'd be good to have a ship visiting port so that we can have someone introduced into the situation so they can react to it as a new situation. And I went, okay, U.S. Navy ships. Shouldn't be a battleship's too big, destroyer's too small. Let's see a heavy cruiser. Well, I know from another project that there was a U.S. heavy cruiser named the USS Augusta, and that's my wife's name, so I like that name. So I look up the USS Augusta. In fact, the USS Augusta was in crisscrossing the South Pacific in 1937. It was, or 38. It was carrying, turns out it was carrying Admiral Harry Yarnell, who was the head of the Asiatic Fleet. I was like, well, there's a political target. So maybe they're not trying to wipe out the island. Maybe they're trying to wipe out the Admiral of the Pacific, the Asiatic Squadron. So all of that, getting to Harry Yarnell on the USS Augusta comes all the way from, I need an island in the Pacific with a U.S. base on it. And it all sort of grows to the point where it's like, oh, well, now I have a historical figure who was really there, who was, you know, I have a throwaway line about how a Shanghai admiral, Harry Yarnell was in Shanghai observing the situation with the Japanese invasion of China. Again, not germane to the Doc Savage story at all. But if you have an interest in the subject, there it is. There's an oblique reference to a whole other epic story of the Japanese invasion. And it also, I'm big on historical things having the flavor. What were people talking about? What would have they been talking about?
Right.
If you set a scene June 8th, 1944 in American City, everyone would be talking about D-Day. You know what I mean? Like, so you have to be aware that Navy sailors 1938 in the South Pacific are going to be talking about the Japanese invasion of China. That's going to be the topic on their minds. That's a way of using history. And I always say, research gives you the story on a silver platter. It hands it to you.
Yeah.
If you didn't know it to begin with, there it is, waiting for you. History is full of great stories. And later in the story, because again, it's a thing of interest to me, I introduce an older Japanese vice admiral and his adjutant, a captain, and they, without great subtlety, I will completely confess, they represent the schizophrenia of the Japanese military high command at the time. There's the kid. The kid wants war with America, which is foolish and they're going to lose. And the older, wiser vice admiral thinks it's all crazy and foolish. And his criticism of Sunlight's weapon, Sunlight's apocalyptic weapon, allows me to put a monologue that would absolutely describe how horrible the atomic bomb is in the mouth of a Japanese admiral in 1938. He's talking about something else, but he's saying this is a cowardly thing, this is a villainous thing, there's no honor in this thing. And again, how the research gives you the thing, I looked up, you know, old guys like that admiral would be members of a samurai household, maybe. A lot of them have that go back, you know, that tradition going back 600, 1,000 years in their families. So I looked up the Bushido Code and his monologue about what's wrong with Sunlight's super weapon. He literally is going down the list of things in the Bushido Code that it violates. I never say that out loud. He doesn't say, here's how Sunlight's weapon violates the Bushido Code, but that thing is so burned into him that instead of just having him give a generic list of things he objects to, it is not honorable. It is not this. It is not, you know, I will confess I didn't memorize the Bushido Code. But again, it's like that's a case where I could have just written the dialogue free of any influence of real Japanese culture and history, or I can have the vice admiral quoting the Bushido Code to his younger staff officer, who would know what he's talking about, by the way. He would recognize those bullet points as, oh yeah, that's the Bushido Code. Right. Anyway, so that's a very long-winded how historical information weaves its way into, and knowing the, at trying to have a grasp of the situation, what was on people's minds, what they were thinking about at the time of your story, it gives you everything.
You know, it's interesting because you talk about the Japanese cat. A lot of this is really kind of beautifully kind of weaves into one of the hypotheses regarding the disappearance, which I'm sure you're familiar with.
Sure.
And that's the Japanese capture hypothesis with Amelia Earhart. After obviously World War II and Pearl Harbor, you know, Japan is sort of public enemy number one for America, and we're going at it with them. I guess, does it make sense to you to, I mean, because Amelia Earhart is such, she's America's sweetheart. She really kind of still is to this day. Does it just from a story standpoint just make sense to you that she would be kind of the one that sort of helps save the day and kind of in sacrificing herself? Of course, we're going to put a spoiler tag, by the way, at the beginning.
Yeah, sure. But
sacrificing herself for the greater good and kind of, is that something that you thought about, you know, extensively or not extensively, really about kind of how that fits into Amelia's character and what she might have done if she was in that situation?
I think she was a big one for, I mean, look, she sacrificed, regardless of fictional worlds, she absolutely sacrificed her life in the name of science and progress. And you can say she was a glory hound, but she had plenty of glory when she did that. She was not an unknown person. I don't think she was grasping on for publicity. I think she really was that person who wanted to see what was on the other side of the mountain more than she wanted to go on breathing. I think that's what defines someone like that. I mean, look at Armstrong stepping on the moon. It's like there's a million scenarios in which that guy burns to death pretty horribly before he gets there. He's sitting on a bomb that was less than 3 years ago killed a bunch of his friends before they even got to the launching pad. And that's what defines that kind of person. And that's the poem that I used is, you know, life is only worth living if you take those kind of risks for someone like that. On the one hand, there's the desire to portray her heroism, her real life heroism. I can't say that I started from a pretty fuzzy outline and I knew in my heart that it didn't have a happy ending. There are too many stretches required to have, and then Amelia lived happily ever after, but we never heard about it for some unknown reason. So I kind of knew going in she had to die. So you go, okay, well, what makes that worth it? And in our case, it's the Japanese are about to use a super weapon that's going to destroy the San Francisco Bay Area and kill a million people. And she just rams an airplane into another airplane to stop it. It came out pretty organically. There were things that, and again, I feel like, because of the seat of the pants flying that you have to do because of the speed of comic books, I think I've gotten okay at setting enough dominoes up in the first few issues that by the time I get to the end, I go, well, okay, I left the Lockheed Electra intact and parked on a field in case it needed to be part of the climax. Well, it does. And that gives me an even better excuse because Doc Savage would always want to be the guy to sacrifice himself. But she can always argue, that's my plane, Doc. I fly it better than you. You know, you're the greatest pilot in the world, but this is my plane and you don't get to fly it and I'm better at it. This is the one thing I'm better at than you. So all of that stuff. And again, the love story, which I'm sure you'll want to get to, between Pat and Amelia, again, has to have a tragic ending. And when I wrote the lines in the first issue where she says, you know, Doc, you have to, I believe she's alive. I believe she's out there. You have to do something about it, where he says to her, you know, you always try to implant the theme, you know, what theme is a good theme, speaking story-wise, for someone trying to find out the truth about what happened to their best friend, their lover. And even not knowing where it was really going, I had Doc say, sometimes you don't really, you're not going to be happy when you know what really happened to her. It's not going to feel better knowing she crashed in the ocean or got captured and tortured by the Japanese. Or like, I know it feels bad now that it's a mystery, but you might not, half the solutions this mystery has are terrible. You know, so yeah. I'll go solve it for you, maybe, but be prepared for a sad, sad ending to this story. And so it is, you know.
I argue that when I talk in media and stuff a lot, I argue that really, if you look at all these hypotheses in and of themselves, none of the outcomes are pleasant. She either crashed in the ocean and drowned, or by herself, or with Noonan, she was either executed on Saipan, or one of the variations under that umbrella. Even if she came back to the United States and you know, the whole Irene Bolam hypothesis comes into fruition, that's a really sad, lonely ending, because she couldn't have talked to anybody. Essentially, she did die, and she had to live out another life. So, I mean, none of these are really pleasant, and it's quite unfortunate. So I definitely get what you're talking about there.
Yeah.
What I wanted to move on to a little bit is just the relationship between her and Doc. Can you talk a little bit about that for the folks who haven't yet read the book or read the comics? Can you talk a little bit about the relationship between Doc and Amelia once they actually hook up and meet up? What does Doc think of Amelia? What does Amelia think of Doc? Can you kind of enlighten?
I didn't. Unfortunately, there's not a lot of, they don't share a lot of screen time together. I think if you put it all together, there may be 10 minutes in each other's company. But obviously, they would admire each other. They stand for the same things. They do the same things. They're believers in education and progress and science, and, you know, that cult of science from the 20s to the 30s that, you know, that does eventually get us the atomic bomb. And that's a, you know, and that's a subtext in it too. Doc's story is that he invented this stuff and someone stole it from him, and maybe you shouldn't go around inventing doomsday weapons and assuming you have the ability to keep them from falling into the wrong hands, because they will always fall. That's the lesson Doc learns, which is building very much off something that Lester Dent wrote before the atomic bomb. But a lot of guys saw that kind of thing coming. But I think it's what made me want to use Amelia is the similarity between the two characters, that they're both morally square in the sense, in the best possible sense, of in terms of the betterment of their fellow human beings, they can always be counted on to do the right thing or to want to do the right thing. And if they're not doing the right thing and it's pointed out to them, they change course. They do something different. And, you know, and undeniably, Amelia would have to remind him of his sister, even if they weren't, or his cousin, excuse me, even regardless of the specific circumstances. But Pat Savage is an entrepreneur and an aviatrix and a feminist and all of those things at a time when no one is those things. So, you know, I have absolutely no knowledge that Pat was in any way influenced by, like, the creation of Pat as a literary character being influenced by Amelia Earhart. I've never seen an interview about that. But the characters have very similar biographies, except Amelia doesn't have the leg up of having, you know, the most connected superhero cousin in the world. But, you know, and Pat has a salon in New York City, a very expensive salon, and Doc Savage always complains that she's a bigger crook than half of the guys he busts because she's asking, you know, X amount of dollars for a foot massage or whatever. And that reminds me of the fact that even a feminist icon in the 30s, Amelia Earhart had clothing lines. You know, she had they threw a lot of girly stuff at her. And you cannot deny, and I don't think Amelia would have denied, that she's the icon she is because she's the pretty one. She may have been a better pilot than Poncho Barnes. I think that's, but one of them looked like Hilary Swank and one of them looked like Kathy Bates. And the publicity went to the one that looked like Hilary Swank. You know, the publicity went to the supermodel with the cool haircut, not to the, you know, the chubby average looking gal. One of the ways in which history fails people, I think, is this, and this isn't Amelia's fault at all, but Poncho Barnes is forgotten largely, or remember mostly as the bartender, maybe brothel owner, that she became in the 50s and 60s when she was an old woman. People don't realize there were enough female aviators to have contests between them, and Amelia didn't always win those contests. And there were absolutely people who grumbled that she wasn't a good flyer, she was the pretty one, with the millionaire supporting her. But that's not borne out by her flying.
And that's what I was going to mention too, is that it probably certainly didn't hurt her case that she had, her cause rather, that she had George Putnam behind her, who was a powerhouse in publishing. And just when he saw her, he just, he saw something in her. I mean, he'd published Lindbergh's book 5 years earlier. I mean, he knew what he was doing. He was a
he was looking for supermodel Lindbergh, and he found her. You know, he was looking for Lady Lindbergh. And I think, you know, whenever you look at accounts like that, one of my big fields of study when I was, you know, since I was a kid has been Ulysses S. Grant. And whenever I hear that someone's repeating that Amelia Earhart wasn't such a hot pilot, I think about all of the people don't like it when relatively lower middle class, lower class people find themselves the most famous and popular people in the world. You find a lot of their rivals who are where they are because of inherited wealth or are just simply jealous and from the same social strata. There is a little bit of a look at how they treated Bill Clinton when he became president because he wasn't born with a silver spoon in his mouth. And the same's true of Barack Obama. That there's that thing where the people who are where they are because daddy got them into Harvard look at a Ulysses S. Grant who was not a political appointee and became the leader of the biggest military the world has ever known up until its time out of sheer, well, I won a lot of battles, so they kept promoting me and now I'm in charge of everything. Instead of my daddy was a senator and they gave me an army with 100,000 guys because my daddy's a senator. So I think Amelia's got a little bit of that, of her reputation suffers in some quarters because of people. There are contemporary accounts from people who are like, well, the hell with her, you know, who died and made her king of the universe or queen of the universe. But it's like, but whenever I hear that, I compare it to Grant and go, no, this is just a contemporary who's mad that she's on the cover of Life magazine. That's ultimately, same thing, all of the things you hear about Grant being a drunkard and all, it's like, every general in the Civil War was a drunkard. He was the one everyone was mad at. He was the one beating the pants off of Robert E. Lee. So, has to be something wrong with him. You know, has to be something we can knock him for. We can't knock him for his generalship, you know. Though, again, they say he's a, you know, the cliches about him being a butcher and all that. If you put the casualty rates between him and Lee side by side, they're almost identical. They burned up men at the same rate. Lee just had less men to burn up. But the overall point being that there's a certain type of hustling, lower economic strata American hero who, when they die, their enemies' lies about them tend to outlive them a little bit. And you have to be careful about that. I think you can look at Amelia's record and go, no, she's a pretty hot shit pilot, actually. You know, took an autogyro up with no training. And that's a very difficult thing. I'm not a pilot, but I know that's a very difficult thing to keep in. An experimental autogyro is not the easiest thing to keep in the air.
You know, I want to ask you something because you mentioned it earlier about feminism a little bit, because we talked to Susan Ware, who wrote Amelia Earhart and The Search for Modern Feminism, one of our project guests early on in the show. Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask you what you feel Amelia's overall role was in feminism at that time, and then what it's kind of morphed into in the 21st century. Because I know it's really big, obviously. It's kind of gradually gotten bigger, but it's exploded, as you and I both know, in the last year.
Sure.
Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure, absolutely. There was no way she couldn't be aware of how singular her achievements were for women at the time. And there was no way she couldn't be aware of how hard things were made for her. You know, there's two kinds of people in the world who achieve great things. The ones who look at the ladder and kick it over, and the ones who lower it a little bit, hoping that people can climb up the way they climbed up. And she absolutely dedicated, almost from the minute she became popular, she went into teaching aviation immediately, and she focused on female students as much as she possibly could and recruit. She tried to get Eleanor Roosevelt to go on a barnstorming tour with her, and FDR said, people are out of your mind. You can't take the first lady on a two-seater airplane alone across the country without a security detail. It's the craziest idea in the world. And of course, Eleanor loved that idea. And Eleanor is also, I'm sure, a big influence on her, another feminist icon from the time. So, but yeah, she was very aware of the responsibility she had as a successful public woman. I mean, there's man's fields and then there's man's, you know, like in pilots, it's a I mean, Russia has the first female astronaut in 61, 62. Sally Ride is 1984, 83.
Yeah.
American culture is nuts in that respect. And Amelia is definitely way before all of that. So she took that responsibility very seriously. She went around all of the women's colleges giving lectures on entrepreneurship and influencing women to join, you know, to learn how to fly and be flyers. So I think she was the best kind of, modern feminist in that she absolutely understood that she lived in a patriarchal world. She absolutely understood that she was pushing back against it. And she tried her best to develop allies to continue to push back. And she used powerful men as a way of pushing back against their own power. And that's what you have to do.
You think she'd be proud of where we're at right now?
I think she'd be depressed out of her mind that it was where it still is. I think she would be amazed that there was still a pay gap. I mean, in the same how we feel, men of my generation, and you're a little younger, I think, but in the same way we joke about where's my jetpack, I think Amelia Earhart would be like, 80% of airline pilots are still men? Are you friggin' kidding me? After all that I did in the 30s, that didn't prove to people. The Air Force, like literally, we have women flying combat missions for the first time, like what, 5 years ago? There have been women fighter pilots in the Russians had women fighter pilots in the 40s. The Israelis have had them since there's been a state of Israel, you know, but America somehow. And the thing people don't realize that it's all of a piece, that it's the same thing with astronauts. The reason there are no female astronauts is the first couple of generations of astronauts are ex-fighter pilots, because that's the top of the pyramid. I knew airline pilots when I was a kid growing up. They were all World War II flying aces in their 50s. You know, so if there's no female World War II flying ace in their 50s, they're not going to give them a 747. So I think she would be depressed about that. She would be glad that people were still fighting, but I think she would be amazed how little progress has been made, honestly, and how much progress there is still to be made. I think if you're Amelia Earhart in 1937, you probably think there could be a female president in 10 years.
You know, it's funny. We attended one of the lectures from Dr. Anita Sengupta. She's a rocket scientist. She designed a supersonic parachute for the Curiosity rover. And she was doing a presentation with us in Santa Monica for a bunch of people, and we were there. And she showed us this photo, and they're out like in the desert. They're testing, I guess, simulating the atmosphere of Mars, and they're testing kind of the parachute prototypes. And the photo is like her and like 25 dudes, and that's it. There's like no other women. And she mentioned in the presentation that, you know, we are making some progress on like on law and on medical and stuff as well, but we need to get many more women into like engineering and science and aviation and just all that stuff. And it's just interesting to see kind of her thoughts on that and then kind of echo what you're talking about now and just kind of how low the numbers actually are that when somebody like, you know, astronaut Abby or Shasta Ways does these historic things. I mean, I'm happy, overjoyed that they're making such a big deal out of it, but I feel like it shouldn't be that. I'm not taking away from them, but it should be commonplace now. Like it should be just common.
That's exactly it. It's way too late in our history and our culture for it to be as extraordinary as it seems. And that's, that's in every field. I remember having an argument with a musician friend of mine who was saying that women don't like jazz. And I said, what's your conclusion that says women don't like jazz? He's like, well, where are the great women trumpet players? I was like, who have they got to follow in the footsteps of? If you're a woman and you love jazz and you walk into a jazz club in the 1940s, they're going to hand you a microphone and you better be pretty, you know? And if you're not pretty, you better have an amazing voice. And there are a lot of women out there for that. There are a million women with acoustic guitars who sing because you can look and they're, well, okay, that's possible. That's a thing I can do. So I'll do that thing because it's a thing that women can do. I've never seen a woman. I've been in jazz clubs most of my adult life. I've never seen a woman playing a trumpet ever. I've seen a woman playing a bass. And again, it's not that everything is role modeling, but there's something to be said for when you're a child, you perceive what is possible in the universe by what you can see, you know? And if you're a 12-year-old girl and you hit that spot where they say, choose an instrument, it takes a tremendous leap of the imagination to go, I'm gonna play the trumpet. And I'm sure that every little girl that's ever said that out loud, I bet you $1 million, the music teacher has said, what about a flute? What about a clarinet? It's very, again, the insurmountability of a 12-year-old saying to an adult authority figure, no, I want to be a pilot. I don't want to be a medic. I don't want to be support staff. I want to fly fighter planes. That's what I want to do. The woods are full of women who want to fly fighter planes. I have no doubt of that. But no one lets them in, and no one has the imagination for it. And that's all it is. And to move on to a broader topic in the arts, I've been thinking about this a lot lately. You hear a certain kind of dire white boy fan talk about how all this forced diversity. There's no such thing as forced diversity. The world is diverse. Your comic book where everyone is a white man, that's the forced segregation. Very few, unless your superhero comic takes place in a small town in Wyoming, there should be women and people of color involved in your antics. And it is a crushing down of reality to pretend that there's a reality that doesn't involve women. And honestly, I have to say, one of the reasons I chose the Amelia Earhart story for my Doc Savage thing is, oh boy, are those pulps a man's world. There's usually one female character. And, you know, you may or may not have heard of the Bechdel test, but I was like, I'm going to write the first Doc Savage adventure that passes the Bechdel test, where two women have a conversation with one another that's longer than a minute, and the characters both have names. You can't apply the Bechdel. We were just watching The Terror last night. Okay, a show about a British Navy vessel trapped in the Antarctic. Very acceptable to have only white guys on that show. Because that...
it fits. North
Arabia, yes, there is no place for women in that story. That is a story about a gay dude and a bunch of Arabs making war on the Turks. There's no feminine presence in the real historical story. But anything that's not about a submarine crew or an expedition in the Antarctic in the 19th century. Last thing on this topic, Isaac Asimov in 47 writes Foundation, which is about a team of scientists who are so good at predicting the future. It's so good at sociology, history, they call it psychohistory. In this book about scientists who are geniuses at predicting the future, there are no female characters until page 147. The first female character that shows up is a slave girl who is modeling a piece of jewelry. 10 pages later, a space Lady Macbeth appears, has one scene. Now, Isaac, absolutely, by the second book, I think if I remember correctly, I haven't read the rest of the trilogy in years, I think the rest of the series has a female protagonist. So I think he pulled it out of that swan dive. But I've made that observation once I think it was on IO9, and a bunch of fanboys came at me with like, well, it was a product of the time. And I'm like, Lois Lane is 15 years earlier. Wilma Deering in Buck Rogers is 20 years earlier. Deja Thoris from John Carter is 1914. Like, you can't tell me that by 1947, a science fiction writer trying to predict the future, writing a book in which there are no women who are school teachers, college professors, statesmen, soldiers, no job, that the whole book is about governments and science organizations, and it's like there are no women of any kind. And it's just, and my point being is, it's not, among everything else, it's a failure of imagination. It's a writer sitting at a typewriter writing about people, and he peoples the entire book with variations on Isaac Asimov, because it just never occurs to him and go, maybe this guy should be Pakistani or a woman,
right?
Or a guy with a club foot, or, you know, someone in a wheelchair, or, you know, like, it's just, no, everyone's kind of like me. So, and again, like I said, whatever one might think about Isaac Asimov, by the second novel, I think he went, ooh, geez, it's embarrassing, and fixed it. You're writing about a rich real world, or you're writing about this weird, closed off, hermetic, fake world.
It's like the same people that complained about the diversity in the school for Spider-Man Homecoming when they said it in New York, obviously. And it's
Queens.
Like, in New York, it's in Queens. Yeah. Like, you know, you've been there, right? Like, you know, it's not just a bunch of white people walking around. Like, it's one of the most diverse little compact areas on the planet. So
yeah, and again, that's why, you know, you set things in New York because it's interesting and it's diverse. And if you didn't want it to be like that, I'm sure you can find a city somewhere that is less diverse than New York. And that goes on to another, you know, the whole thing about living in a bubble. I'm like, I don't know. I think the people who live in major cities and meet people from all over the world, including people from small towns, by the way, are the ones not living in the bubble. And the people who never move outside of the 25-mile radius of the hospital they were born in never meet someone from another culture. Never have no idea what anyone else is. It's like whenever you see, I think there was a, they did a statistical analysis after Brexit, and they discovered that everyone who had voted to sort of cut England off from the rest of the world and close the borders and hated immigrants so much, none of them lived anywhere near to any immigrants. None of them had met an immigrant. People who live in proximity to immigrants wanted open borders, wanted free travel to the rest of Europe because they're not afraid of it because they've experienced it. And I think, again, not to get too far off on a political rant, the reason conservatism pushes so hard against things like gay marriage is because they know that when you make it legal, 5 years later, there's no ability to point to it and say, see how it ruined everything? Because it's just not going to ruin. You can only object to it in the abstract, like Medicare, like Medicaid, like Social Security. Once it's been given to people, it's very hard to say, see how this turned America communist and ruined your life? It's like, no, I just get a check when I'm out of work. I'm sorry. What? That's bad? The money I get every week when I'm out of work is making me a communist? I'm, you know, so it's conservatism is the act of not letting the genie out of the bottle, because the minute the genie's out of the bottle, gay marriage has been around for 5 years now, and heterosexual marriage seems to be doing okay. Like, you know, it's not a... So anyway, that's the... And it's the same thing with feminism. It's to bring it all the way back around. The minute you have women in every job field, you can't any longer say, well, women can't do this job because X, Y, and Z.
Speaking of going full circle, early in the conversation, you mentioned why you wanted to take on... One of the reasons why you wanted to take on the Doc Savage project and kind of bring Amelia into the fold, so to speak, and that reason that you had mentioned was that you wanted to kind of take a stab at writing a different ending to her story. And it got me thinking when you were talking about that, you know who else does that or does a lot of that? Children do a lot of that when it comes to Amelia Earhart. And we do a lot of the History Day talks, and I'll have to send you some stuff via email so you can check this out. It's really fascinating to see what these kids come up with as the ending for Amelia Earhart. When I was in third grade, I remember... it was really simple for me. I just thought she flew off into the sunset. There was nothing left for her to do, and I used to imagine she'd send me a postcard on one of her adventures every once in a while. Then I even gave a third grader. But my point being is that you taking on this subject and kind of bringing all this into the fold, it kind of ties directly into what a lot of kids do. And I'm wondering if you can kind of speculate a little bit as to why kids do that when it comes to this woman in particular, do you think?
I think it's because she's so clearly heroic. Untested technology and bad luck has killed most of the explorers. You know, we know the name of Sir Edmund Hillary, but we attribute the most famous quote attributed to Sir Edmund Hillary was actually said by Mallory, whose bones bleached the side of Everest. So you want the happy, like I said, people want the happy ending so much that they turn Mallory and Hillary into one guy so they can imagine the guy that said, because it's there, is the guy that didn't die doing it, you know, right. And that's, I think it's a natural thing. You want, you know, I'm trying to remember who advanced this process, but happily ever after is always, happy endings are a literary device, and you can have one if you put it in the right place. You know, like if you pick the moment where you go, and that was the moment that everything looks great. And I think, you know, honestly, one of the reasons people object to, I love the current Star Wars trilogy, but what people object to about them is it's mature. It goes, you know what? Han and Leia weren't really perfect for each other, and that marriage was going to fall apart, and they did end up having a shitty kid, and Luke did get disappointed in being a Jedi, considering that all of his mentors lied to him. You know, like, there's something very mature in, yeah, right after they blew up that second Death Star, they were all very happy, and that maybe lasted for a few years, and then everybody dies, everybody gets old, you know, and sometimes you have a happy ending to things, and sometimes you never recreate your greatest achievements, and you have to look back and go, no, that was actually the moment where everything was good. With Emilia, I think there's a desire, especially because she died so young and beautiful. She's trapped in amber in her moment of perfection. She vanishes at a moment of perfection when she's beautiful and popular and doing an amazing thing. And the idea that just her radio transmitter was set to the wrong frequency. And I mean, I think I said this during the interview, but one of the things that cracks me up about the conspiracy theories is always just that, having researched it recently, I keep coming back to, it's like, well, guess what? She died in the super dangerous part of the expedition that she had previously identified as the place where they were probably going to die. So, but they even sort of want to take that, you know, the conspiracy angle of it. I love her too and wish a different ending for her. But having so much love for her that you wish she had been captured by the Japanese, tortured, and had her legs broken, and, you know, like, that's better. I don't think that's better or more heroic than crash landing in the ocean or crash landing on an island and dying of starvation a couple of days later or whatever. So there's just a natural, because it's a blank space, you want to fill it with something, and you want to fill it with something nicer than what happened, or you want to fill it with something different, or at the very least, like the people with the various theories that diverge from, I think, what we do know about her, you just want to know. You just want, and again, that's the Doc Savage thing I quoted earlier of him saying, does knowing really make it better? Because I'm not sure it does. And I'll wrap that idea up with a personal note. I've had a couple of friends die in the last 5-10 years, fairly young. Some of them had troubles with drugs. Some of them had personal problems. The last time it happened to me, it was a very close friend, and his family didn't say how he died. And a lot of people asked me, and I said, what possible difference does it make? What difference? He's just gone. He was happy or sad or whatever he was thinking when it happened, but he's just as gone. And filling in that blank, it won't tell you what you think you want to know. And here's the other theory about that, which is sort of related. I think people's fear of death is so great that any death is mysterious, they can't say, well, that would never happen to me. When you find out someone died of a drug overdose, instead of the million other things that could have killed them, you can at least go, well, that's not going to get me. That's not how I'm going to go. And I don't know that people apply that logic to Emilia, but I think overall people are like, if I know the reason for a death, if I know how a death happened, then it is, to speak of it like it's a monster, it's caged, it's bound. That won't happen to me. I will make sure my instruments are working. I will make sure my fuel tank is full, and I won't crash in the Pacific.
Dave, where can everybody find you on social media? Do you have a website and social media?
I have a website and a very large cat. I have a website, which is davidavalonifreelance.com. On Twitter, I'm @davaloni. I don't hide. I'm very easy to find.
Well, this has been a pleasure. I know you got a lot going on, David. Thank you so much for sitting in on the podcast today. We really appreciate having you in.
My pleasure, Chris. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Chasing Earhart podcast, part of our Legacy retrospective series. We hope you've enjoyed the show. Come back to ChasingEarhart.com each week for another new podcast. While at ChasingEarhart.com, visit our archives and our blog to hear all of our past episodes and interviews with guests such as Brad Meltzer, Tom Vinson, Candace Fleming, Jessica Cox, Abigail Harrison, and Shasta Ways. You can also hear interviews with representatives of all of the relevant hypotheses regarding the disappearance of Emilia Earhart and Fred Noonan, such as Tom King, Dick Spink, Gary LaPook, Rick Gillespie, Andy Sherrill, and more. Also at our site, you can find hundreds more posts, project updates, and much more information regarding the life and disappearance of Emilia Earhart. The Chasing Earhart podcast is a show without any sponsors or ads. We rely on support from listeners like you to keep the Chasing Earhart Project operating. You can donate to the show and as our thank you, receive bonus podcasts, merchandise, and advanced opportunities for Chasing Earhart events. Find a full list of available shows and rewards at patreon.com/chasingearhart. You can also follow the project on social media, where our team posts all of our shows, news, and project information. And that hashtag is @ChasingEarhart. The Chasing Earhart podcast is produced by Vanessa Williamson and edited by Tom Myers. Podcast music is provided by Dane Jarrus Schmidt, and narration is done by Forrest Burgess. The opinions on Chasing Earhart are those of the individual guests and may not reflect those of Chris Evan Films Incorporated. Chris Evan Films Incorporated is not affiliated with the films or clips referred to herein. All movie clips and audio used in this podcast are the intellectual property of their respective copyright holders. They are included here for the purpose of historical education, and no infringement is intended. The Chasing Earhart podcast is an exclusive trademark of Chris Evan Films Incorporated and may not be used without the express written consent of Chris Evan Films Incorporated. All rights reserved. The Chasing Earhart podcast is a Chris Evan Films production. Copyright 2018. All rights reserved.